You're listening to the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association.
Statistics.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the show. This is Richard Zink, and you're listening to the podcast of the Biopharmaceutical Section of the American Statistical Association. This is episode 52, and it features a conversation on the PSTAT and GSTAT ASA accreditations with Zoltan Harsanyi, Janet McDougall, and Teresa Utlaut. Now, I hope you listen to the entire podcast. And you'll hear that as a graduate student, there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't pursue the GSTAT accreditation. And for my colleagues in industry, I want you to consider obtaining the PSTAT designation yourself, expecting it of your employees, and mentioning it to your non-statistical colleagues that it's one way to be sure you've identified a qualified statistical candidate. Now, as a reminder for these discussions, please note that people are sharing their personal opinions, so please don't overinterpret their comments as representing the groups or organizations with which they participate. Now let's start the show. So hi, folks. Our topic today is ASA accreditation. I'm talking with Zoltan Harsanyi, freelance consultant of ZBH Consulting, Janet McDougall, president and senior statistician of McDougall Scientific Limited, and Teresa Utlaut, principal engineer and statistician at Intel Corporation. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and thanks so much for being here. Well, before we get started, how about each of you give us a brief overview of your current roles?
Sure. Yeah, Zoltan Harsanyi. Well, I've spent about over 30 years in the pharmaceutical industry and recently retired from Purdue Pharma. And basically, I am retired now, but also looking at opportunities as a consultant to work in some of the same areas that I had been in the past, but I'm also enjoying my retirement. So it's, you know, it's one of those, I'm okay as I am. So I'm not really being very aggressive about finding new work.
Mm-hmm. And were you a clinical statistician at Purdue Pharma?
Yes, that's right. I was, and most of my time in the pharma industry was working in the clinical area. Although I did dabble in the pharmacokinetics and the phase one, phase two research areas, but for the most part, it was always clinical. And in Canada, you know, we tend to have smaller groups, so there's a tendency more for people to do a lot of different things as opposed to be as specialized. You get more specialization in, you know, in the U.S. and some of the larger companies in Canada. That doesn't happen very often.
Interesting. Janet, how about you?
Yeah, I'm Canadian as well, so our company is a niche CRO. We're primarily statisticians and data managers working in the clinical trials area. I've had the company for about 35 years now, so we do all phases of the trials, same as what Zoltan was talking about, and we also support applications which are necessary to do the statistics, like doing the electronic data capture and, you know, randomizations, and we're now launching an ETMF, the Electronic Trial Master File, which supports the clinical trials. We do work a little bit outside the trial space because statistics are portable, but as we all know, once you get an area of expertise, that particularly in clinical trials, because you're balancing the theory with the regulations, designing the trials and everything is just a fabulous feast now with all the adaptive by design and everything. So we're kept pretty busy trying to keep up with the latest and greatest ways to move forward.
And do you work in any particular therapeutic areas?
No, we work across the board. I mean, it's tends to be where the research money is. So right now there's tend to be a lot of research money in oncology. So we're seeing a lot of phase one oncology work, which we hadn't seen for a while. And that's, again, because many of our clients are the smaller biotechs. It's where the investors want to put their money. So we also have a couple of very innovative products coming through, sort of first time ever. They're sort of still in the development stage. They haven't quite hit clinical trials. And then you get we go all the way through to the phase four, which is the real-world experience people. Mm-hmm. So it goes straight across the board and all the way across the therapeutic areas.
Very good. And Terry, what do you do day-to-day at Intel Corporation?
So I work in the development group, so we're working on the latest integrated silicon technologies, and I think the best way to simply describe my job is I'm a consulting statistician. So engineers, they're very data savvy, but when they get themselves in trouble, they will come to me, and I will do my best to help them out. So do a lot of consulting with engineers, a lot of teaching, data analysis, and it's kind of the topic that I cover in terms of statistics varies kind of hour by hour, so it's very exciting, very fast-paced, and very interesting.
And for those of us who may be less familiar, so Intel creates microchips, is that correct?
So if you basically, I'm in the development group, so if you go to Best Buy in 5 years, that's what I'm working on now, if you buy the fastest computer you can buy.
Oh, I see.
PCs, we're getting more into, you know, integrated silicon as well. So,
and what are some of the statistical challenges that you come into day to day? Is it about the manufacturing process?
It varies day to day. What the biggest challenge is, a lot of times with development, we don't have a large sample size, right? So how do you make good decisions with small samples? But then on the other hand, there are times when you have more data than you know what to do with. So how do you make decisions, you know, and pulling information out of that data? We gather an enormous amount of data, right? And information turns is the critical thing. And so making decisions quickly and doing the best I can with, you know, providing a solution in a month is not useful. Providing a solution in 2 hours is useful.
I see.
So how do you make a decision very quickly on what to do about this data? You don't get the opportunity to figure out the optimal solution, usually.
I see. So a lot of thinking outside the box.
Yes. Yes.
All of you are involved now or in the past with the ASA accreditation program. So Zoltan, you are currently the chair of the accreditation committee. Janet, you are a member of the accreditation programming subcommittee, and you are also involved in the Statistical Society of Canada's PSTAT program, which was used as a reference for the ASA model. And Terry, you were involved at the very beginning with the initial development of the ASA accreditation program. Well, can you provide us a little bit of background on the Statistical Society of Canada accreditation development process?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Richard. I actually had to do a little bit of research. Same as with Terry, it's been a while, and it actually started back in June of 1999. A strategic plan for the Statistical Society of Canada came out, and one of the things that they saw was a need to accommodate the statisticians outside of the academic world. They decided they wanted to put together some kind of section for the practicing statisticians, and they actually mentioned in there that they would like to look at a certification model like the ASTAT for the Australian society. So the ASTAT for Australia is the accredited statistician. It's their full accreditation. They had just put that together after a lot of thinking and mulling over and looking expertise and other models. They'd put it together in 1996. So Australia was accrediting their statisticians as early as 1996. And again, the focus was on the combination of both education and experience, because the educational component of statistics is actually quite new. I looked in one of the National Society, NSF, had a publication on graduate degrees across time, sort of, and I looked at the statistics, and for the last decade, for 1990 to 1999, there were fewer than 2,000 PhDs given out in statistics, and that includes statistics, math stats, biostats, educational stats, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see that the educational component was not as strong. So they were looking at people who had grown up through, you know, through the practitioner's world, particularly engineers, Terry, because they're pretty good. They're pretty good in quality. They're pretty good with math. And and they wanted to make sure that they could accredit them with their experience, but they needed 10 years of experience. And then if you did have much more formal education, then that came down to 6 years, and that was the model that that SSC ended up developing. Not with the I don't believe they did the 10-year one, but they said at least stick, you know, the education and experience to do the task performed. So it was I was part of the initial committee setting that up with a guy called Ken McCrae. He was really the backbone of the whole thing and saw it through. So we had our first accreditation in 2004, and ASA did theirs in 2009. So all the societies are very closely together. The only one who was way ahead of us was the Royal Statistical Society of the UK. But they had started so early. They actually taught statistics courses and had people sit statistical exams, etc. And they themselves have now also gone over to the model, which is the combination of, they no longer do that. They're looking to the educational institutes to supply the educational background, and then they're looking for the experience that shows you, you know, your body of work is such that you actually know what you're doing with statistics.
So that was an introduction to the Canadian model that was built off the Australian model. And when did the ASA formally decide that they needed to develop their accreditation program?
I was going to say, with ASA, it goes back decades, really, right? I mean, the discussion of it, anyway, it goes back decades. And when I first was asked to be on the proposal to put something together to send to the board to see if we should have an accreditation program, I think that was in, well, the committee formed in 2007. And when I was asked, I wasn't even sure it was the right thing for ASA at that point, right? Because there had been so much controversy in the previous years that I thought, is this really right? And I actually, Stu Hunter, in his presidential address in 1994, it's the paper's published in JASA, and it's called Statistics as a Profession. He goes through why, he called it certification, and he was talking exam-based, and the ASA accreditation model is not exam-based, it's portfolio-based. After I read that article, I said, you know, this is the right thing for ASA to do. This is a good thing for the profession, and it's something that will help the profession. So 2007 is when we call it the Batcher Committee. It was Mary Batcher who was the chair of the committee. She was asked to put together a proposal to take to the board and what components should be included. And fortunately, we had the Canadian model, we had the Australian model, and we had the Royal Statistical Society, those models to draw from, right? So we examined those and took components from each one, copied things at will, right, and ended up putting a proposal together. And then once that proposal went to the board formed a different committee led by, I think it was John Kettenring led that committee, and they did some more research and did a survey. And the membership of ASA was very much in favor of an accreditation program at that point in time. So the controversy seemed to have gone away, and people were saying, yes, let's do this. And so I think it was more than 40% in the survey said they were interested in becoming accredited. So it was a large number. Once that was in place, then it was a matter of, now we need to figure out how to implement this. And if we're going to do this, and it's, you know, 40% of our population of ASA is interested in doing this, we need to be able to do it in a manner that will be able to harness all these people needing to do this. So we were actually, one of the concerns we had was we were concerned about getting too many applications all at once. And so we put something in place for that as well, where you put your name on a list to apply, and then we gradually went through that list. So the factors that led to it was really, the main one was that survey that was done that said, you know, are you interested in this? And there was an overwhelming response of yes.
So you mentioned the putting your name on a list and sort of cascading people in over time. Is that still a concern?
No,
applications?
No, we didn't. When we started it and we started accepting applications, you know, we had a list of people, but we went through it fairly quickly, and we did not get the estimated, you know, 40% that the survey was guessing it would be, right? So it was it did not take off at the rate of the survey. And I think part of that is, you know, people were willing to do it until they had to actually do the work for it, right? And the application process is not that bad. It, I mean, Richard, you probably looked at it some, saying you were thinking about doing it. It's, you know, if you have your resume in place and you have your experience and you've written, you know, some papers, it's fairly straightforward to do. So.
Yeah, I think that's correct. You know, I think, and writing a letter and getting some letters of support from a few individuals. And I guess that brings up a good point that I always like to try to tell people in keeping your CV updated. I've gotten in the habit of keeping my CV updated in real time. So anytime something happens, I add it. I always recommend that to students as something to get in the habit of doing. So if you feel like you're going to make a change in your career, you don't have to spend a bunch of time trying to figure it out over the last several years what it is you've been doing that, you know, potential employers may find interesting. So, and if you get in that habit too, then doing an accreditation be a little bit more straightforward.
It's funny you say that. That was my biggest challenge because I hadn't done a resume or CV since I'd started at Intel, right? It was the only job I'd ever had. And so it was, you know, 15 years into my job, and I was like, oh, I need to do this now. And so I update it yearly now. So I agree with your recommendation.
I was the same way when I was at Purdue. I didn't bother updating my CV or resume. But it's a fabulous suggestion because these days it's not always a voluntary issue. Sometimes things happen. And it's good to be ready.
Yeah, that's true. Definitely within pharma, there's always that potential.
As a consultant, I've always had to keep mine up to date because people ask us that. That's how they judge you more than anything. But we're very strict around here that people have to keep their all the courses that they take. Though even if it's a WebEx that they're sitting on, if they go off to a conference, if they give a paper, whatever it is. But that's also first of all, that shows our clients that we're keeping up. But if from an accreditation point of view, you should be logging all that because for us in Canada anyway, we used to have to fill in things to say what we've been doing, and now it's kind of left to the person's integrity to keep up to date. But theoretically, anybody can come in and ask to see what courses have you been taking to show that you've been keeping up to date. Some of them can be self-learning, but most commonly they would want to see that you've been sitting in on, let's say you've been listening to Richard's podcasts to make sure you can keep up on what's going on in the area. So that's definitely something that I would encourage anybody who's listening to this, particularly if they're thinking of accreditation. You just have to get into the habit of keeping it up to date in terms of how are you keeping up to date?
Mm-hmm. Well, for a CRO, I think that's really important, Janet, because you're obviously adding value to your service every time, you know, people have additional training and capabilities are augmented. So that's definitely a good business decision, I think. And I think maybe statisticians maybe tend to be a bit humble about things and not always marketing themselves. So it's good to have to encourage people to make sure they're up to date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the ASA has, you know, you have to renew your accreditation every 5 years. And so that, by keeping it up to date, it made it fairly simple for me to renew my accreditation after 5 years.
So you were talking, Terry, about the enthusiasm that was shown by the survey that was done, with 40% thinking it was a good idea. And I noticed when I looked at the number of PSTATs over the years that at the beginning of the program, which I think was about April of 2010, 2011, there were quite a few more. There were more applicants and more people getting PSTAT. And I think it kind of leveled off as the years went by.
Well, Zoltan, can you give us a brief overview of the PSTAT program?
Sure. So I think it's been active since April of 2010, and I had a look at the listing of those with PSTATs, and I counted 326 individuals, and just to follow that, the number of people that were accredited year by year. Like the median is 32, and then the average is 40 between 2010 and 2017. So it's not a huge number, given that I think, and I saw this in Wikipedia, I'm not sure if it's accurate, but there's something like 18,000 members of ASA.
I think that's about right.
Yeah, but I think that's close.
So what is the piece that? So I took this directly from the website. By the way, the website, the ASA website, has a great section on accreditation, which pretty well answers all your questions. And this is a blurb that I saw there. It's accreditation testifies that there is a body of knowledge known as statistics acquired through formal education, work experience, and ongoing professional development activities. So those are the key elements that are examined when you apply for accreditation: is your formal education, your work experience, and the extent to which you've been involved in professional development activities. So what this gives you then is it's a kind of measure that can be used to provide assurance to employers and collaborators about your level of ability to do statistical work. Basically, as Terry has already said, when you become accredited, it lasts for 5 years, after which you need to update your accreditation, which essentially is to show that you are still practicing and involved in statistical activities, and so you need to show evidence of that. Now, professional development is a fairly broad term, so it could be self-learning, could be taking courses, could be attending meetings, JSM. So a wide range of activities are included in that category. Of course, when you apply, you also have to pay a $120 application fee. So that's part of it as well. But it's very streamlined, and when you go to the website, there's clear information on how to proceed and what information is needed. And before you can be assessed, you need to supply all of the elements of the application, that is your letter of application, your information about your background, your CV, and examples of your work, as well as letters from two referees who can attest to your qualities as a professional statistician. And to the extent that these people are also working in the field is highly desirable. And if they're also PSTATs themselves, that's also a good thing. So those are things that are taken into account.
I was just going to say, as somebody who's been a reviewer for accreditation applications, the referees matter a lot, and the background of the referees matters as well.
Yes, for sure. Because sometimes people will put down people that they work with who are not necessarily knowledgeable about statistics, but maybe are the receivers of that information, which is fine. Mm-hmm. But it's preferable to have someone who is also knowledgeable about doing statistical work and does statistical work themselves and is highly qualified. Mm-hmm. So those are all good things.
So, yeah, so anybody listening and considering submitting, make a note of that your referees can judge your statistical work appropriately. Having visited the website myself, just to see what it's out, it's actually a very well-designed website where you're able to submit different pieces as you sort of complete them in the application process. So it's really a very streamlined approach to collecting the information. Well, thanks for the summary about the PSTAT program. And the numbers you gave are actually pretty interesting. I think you mentioned 326 out of 18,000, which if I still remember how to use a calculator, I think that's slightly less than 2% of the individuals in the ASA have obtained an accreditation. So what I want to ask now to hopefully increase those numbers, well, what are the practical benefits of accreditation, and how do we best convince statisticians that it's in their best interest to seek this designation?
Yeah, I think that I always talk to people about the two arms of statistics. I mean, it has a lineage of practitioners and academics who seem to lead very separate lives, and this is something that brings them both together. And I know with some of the vitriol that was being thrown at the we don't want this program, was the academics thought that because you're going to get a PSTAT, that it was a cheap way of pretending you were getting your PhD in statistics. And that was just so far from the reality, because to be truthful, often a PhD in statistics is the worst thing you can bring to the table when you're trying to solve a practical problem. They have to be able to work in the practical field and understand the practitioner's needs. And Terry, you certainly do that on a day-to-day basis dealing with engineers. So no, it wasn't that at all. But this allows, I think it allows the practitioners and the academics to kind of get together. And I found across time that the academics are beginning to understand more and more how they can work to help prepare the students to have a career in statistics, because they can't all become academics. And the practitioners are also beginning to understand, well, I'm going to have to make sure I keep up. And so I think that there's a reaching out across the two voids here when it comes together to be a really high-performing, practically, theoretically-based statistician. It takes both sides to put it together. So when I talk about the benefits of accreditation, I also say to people, once you are accredited, you also become an ambassador. And in everything we say and do, we talk about everyone being accredited. All our people are accredited. The data managers are accredited. The statisticians are accredited. And it's because of the way we speak of it, we show how proud we are that everyone's been able to pass that bar and move it on. And I think it gives the clients confidence more than anything. So it's just the bringing. One of the things that I heard early in the game is, or the academics have had their tenure track forever and ever, and everybody disputes whether it's any good or not, but they all follow it, and that's what gets you your rewards called, you know, your funding coming in, and your graduate students being able to work with you as you go along. You're able to get all these little accolades. That's never been true of the practitioners. The practitioners don't have the same. Our accolades are not that we're going to, some go out and get funding and do research, but it's more or less you're there to help people solve problems. And mm-hmm. in terms of putting together a body of work, I think in 35 years I've had something like 4 publications, and that's it, although I've analyzed hundreds of trials, mm-hmm. because I don't own that data. And it's all secret. It's all for research, you know.
Right, right.
So how can you, the academics publish everything, so you'll see like, you know, 40 pages of publications. You think, wow, that person really knows how to publish. For us, you can't do any of that. And sometimes you can't even tell people about the work that you've done because of that confidentiality that you carry when you're working in research and development. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a nice tool. I think it's a nice shorthand for saying that my peers believe that I am a solidly theoretically based and practically oriented statistician who can help you work to solve your problems. And if you want to stay in academia, then that's fabulous, stay in academia. If you just want to knuckle down and be, I mean, a really good, I think they still have qualifications for quality assurance statisticians, which are, or practitioners that are totally distinct from being a statistician. Some might follow a route like that, but I think most of the people coming out of the statistics programs nowadays, if they wanted to get work, would be interested in working in an applied field, even if that be something as theoretical as our wonderful AI. Everybody has to have thrown AI in there as well. There actually is, deep within the soul of AI, should be some statistics as well.
Well, you mentioned, what are some of the practical benefits? This, I think, how you phrased the question. I was just going to say, well, some of the benefits are, Zoltan had mentioned there was a $120 application fee, which is once, and then you every year it's less money that, or once a year you pay for mm-hmm. being accredited. But in terms of other benefits, so if you're going to take continuing education courses through ASA at either JSM or CSP or also the Women in Statistics and Data Science, you get a discount on those courses, so you get a 20% discount. So you can easily make up that $120 just by taking one of those classes, right? So mm-hmm. in terms of did practical benefits. And then also there's a nice reception at JSM for accredited members. But on the other side, I do agree with Janet 100% about just having that ability to distinguish yourself from other people. And when I say other people, it's a lot of people without the I won't even say without the degree, but without the background in statistics, mm-hmm. without mm-hmm. kind of the core fundamentals of statistics, will call themselves statisticians and have no problem doing that. Now they're calling themselves data scientists too, right? They'll just slap the title at the end of their name and call it good, right? So being able to put that PSTAT logo, I mean, accrediting myself did not help my career within Intel, but when I'm dealing with either our suppliers or our customers and they see that I have that PSTAT after my name and I can use that logo, then, you know, it's usually a question, oh, well, what does that mean? And I explain it to them and they're like, oh, so that means you really know what you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And so I usually answer most of the time, right? Because it's so, but just having that designation where, especially if you're going to do any expert witness work, if you're going to put your work out publicly, I think it's a tremendous benefit.
I've actually heard of a situation where an employer was asking for someone who had a PSTAT, you know, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. I haven't heard. I mean, there must be other instances of that occurring. I haven't been keeping track, but I know of at least one that I remember hearing about. And so I was thinking, well, maybe that's the snowball that will get everything rolling and then people start using it in a, mm-hmm. as a way to determine who they're going to hire,
right.
whether they have a PSTAT or not. Yeah, and I agree with Janet totally in what she was saying about, you know, that we have this need, especially, I mean, this gets into another, something I think we're going to be talking about later on, which is the what benefits there are to those working in the pharma and medical community. And I think it's just augmented in that area because it's a highly regulated area. And so to be able to say you've been vetted, you know, you've been validated by your peers is all to the good in that environment.
I do think that helps a lot for hiring managers who are non-statisticians as well, because mm-hmm. I've run across that where I have a good example. One of my husband's friends is a manager who did some hiring and he needed a statistician and hired a person with a PhD in physics. Mm-hmm. And I met the person, very bright guy, extraordinarily bright guy. But I was training him in statistics, it seemed like continuously, right? And finally, I went and talked to the manager. I said, why did you hire this person as a statistician? He's bright, but he doesn't know statistics. And he said, well, he showed me he could use Excel. And so I thought he'd be fine. After I, passed out for 5 minutes and came back, I had a little talk with him. So, I mean, but he doesn't know he didn't know what to look for, right? Uh-huh. He just thought, well, if the person can pull data, if he can compute a mean, he's good enough to be called a statistician. And so things like that are things we need to fight against if we're going to consider this a profession. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, so you mentioned that at least within Intel, it was more about dealing with people outside of Intel, where the PSTAT sort of gave people comfort in your abilities. And Janet and Zoltan, working in the regulated environment in pharmaceuticals, how do you feel like the PSTAT has benefited you or has it?
Well, I'm not sure if it actually benefited me because I just ended up staying in the same company for a long time and I didn't use it as a way to. But I think it was useful to have, and people notice, and it does help you to get more credibility, as Terry was saying, you know, so you must really know what you're talking about. You know, so there's that side of it, which doesn't hurt. It's just hard to quantify how much it helped. I'm not sure exactly how I would quantify that, but as I was saying earlier, in that field, the idea of validation is just everywhere, and so you have people should be validated as well. So that it kind of is goes along with that whole environment.
Yeah, I think as consultants, it's important because we are dealing with, in many cases, people who are not, they're not very statistically savvy. And unfortunately, a lot of them are MDs, and MDs are, you know, they get three courses in stats, and that's all there is. That's all they have to learn about, and the rest they learn all about it when they go to their meetings, and someone comes up with a new idea, this is how we're all going to do our clinical research, and then they all applaud one another, and they come back and they say, well, this is, you know, this is one size fits all for all the research questions. Mm-hmm. And when you go up against somebody who's really, you know, they're used to being recognized as a world leader, they forget that they're a world leader in their therapeutic area, not necessarily every area associated with the therapeutic area. So I think that when you have to weigh in and try to dissuade the team from going a route that you think is not very effective or efficient in terms of how they're going to actually address the research questions, which are part and parcel of moving this compound through, it helps to have some kind of status, let us say, that you are being recognized by your peers as being a qualified statistician. And that's something that a doctor, no matter how bright they are, who's taken two or three courses, they cannot say that I've been qualified by my statistical peers to be, he or she's been qualified by their medical peers to be a good physician. Right. And as such, we try to bring that over on the other side, that our peers also have said that we are able to bring forward statistical knowledge in an applied way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very, very important difference. And as I said previously, it's often when you're consulting, you don't write papers. You can't. It's, first of all, you don't have time. You don't have the mentoring to do it as well. But most of the material that you're covering is very confidential. So if you don't have a huge CV, which is what they're used to seeing, what do you have to say that you have this breadth of work? And many times it's our philosophy, we don't even mention the companies that we've worked for.
Right, right.
And that some companies don't want people to know that they've got consultants coming in. So you just make the law, and we can mention a therapeutic area because that's wide enough, mm-hmm. but that's about it. So you can say we've worked in these areas. And so because of that vagueness of your background, it really helps that you can put it into place. If someone's interested in the academic world, I'd say stay away from PSTAT because it has nothing to do with what you do on a regular basis. And if you do a bit of consulting on the side, well, you'll just do some consulting on the side. But the way you accredit yourself is with all your research papers. Mm-hmm. So I believe it is important when you're working in a professional area with other professionals.
Mm-hmm. When I was working at Purdue and some of the other companies, I also worked at Wyeth and McNeil. I did get my name on a lot of papers, and it's a bit controversial because basically these were studies that were funded by the pharma companies. So it's sometimes seen as not. I mean, the papers were the first authors were always. Were always the physicians, the principal investigators who actually conducted the studies. So my name was never, I was rarely a first author, if ever. I think I was on one paper. But I did manage to get myself on a lot of, and I'm not sure, that whole question, I guess, of pharma-funded research and the extent to which the results that are published by, in those papers, to what extent are they unbiased? Because, you know, they're being funded by the pharma company, so they must be totally biased. But I, you know, for what it's worth, I've always found that while you try to put your best foot forward, you don't lie. And the studies that we reported were the results we got. They weren't made up. So.
I don't know if we've mentioned that you do have to sign, you know, the ASA ethics document as well when you become a PSTAT. I mean, that's part of
it. I don't think we have, no, but that's an important part of it, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's another thing to consider is that that's also saying you're agreeing to be ethical in your analysis, right?
Right, and I mean, that's one of the pressures you have when you work in a business, you know, that you have to stick by your guns. You have to say if something isn't what it is. I mean, you don't want to make a sow's ear into a silk purse. I mean, if the results aren't there, they're not there. And you you have to stay by that. So it's the way it is. But kind of sometimes it could be, you know, difficult.
Well, you mentioned the example, Terry, about the hiring of the physicist as a statistician. So clearly, I guess for people who aren't who may be hiring statisticians who may not know much about statistics or something, there's some value in having that accreditation so that, you know, you're hiring somebody who would know what they're doing. And I mean, as statisticians yourselves, do you view potential employees differently if they have a presence or an absence of an accreditation?
Well, I do definitely. It depends on whether we're hiring from, you know, whether we're training up through the ranks or whether we're hiring a statistician. But we talk to them even if they're straight out of school and talk to them about the accreditation process, and we make sure that they're willing to come on board as a GSTAT for ASA, or in Canada it's called ASTAT, which is unfortunate because it conflicts with the American with the Australian ones. Mm-hmm. But we want to make sure that they're aware that that's our expectation, mm-hmm. that they will continue to study and learn and be able to be judged by their peers to be competent in about 6 years of practical experience. And then we make sure that they take monitored leadership roles on projects as early as possible so that they get used to making leadership decisions. They're always backed up by a senior until we're sure that they're there. But it's very, very important to us to foster that in somebody who's come on board straight out of school. And if we're looking for a senior person we actually ask why they haven't bothered. And some of them said, I didn't know it existed. Mm-hmm. And that's for all of us to get out there. But many of those statisticians also don't bother to join statistical societies or any society. They just graduate, go looking for a job and, you know, pick a job here, pick a job there, and never really feel like they're part of a community. And I think that's, again, a whole other, given that there's only 18,000 ASA members, I'm sure there's at least 10 times that many out there who are practicing as statisticians.
I think what Janet says is absolutely true, that looking at people and saying, okay, this person is accredited, this person is not. I mean, one thing that tells me is that this person is engaged in statistics as a profession. This person isn't somebody who necessarily wants to come in, get their foot in the door, and then go switch fields, right? So training somebody takes a lot of effort. So if there's somebody who's excited about statistics and wants to do that, and that's what they're calling their profession, that makes me happy, right? was one of the big reasons why we brought in the GSTAT, right, was because that wasn't part of the original program. It's part of the original proposal, but with the amount of members we thought were going to apply, we said, let's do the GSTAT at a second stage, right? So we brought that in at a later time. And part of the reason for that is we tend to hire recent college graduates, and you won't be a PSTAT if you're a recent college graduate because you don't have the experience. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking for some way, at least from my perspective as accreditation, when I was chairing the committee, I said, we should have some way to bring other people in. And other societies have that GSTAT kind of, you know, to mentor people and bring them up as PSTAT. So I think that's important.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you mentioned about people being committed to the profession, but also just, I guess, the accreditation shows an individual's willingness to be proactive in their own development over time. Because I guess it's pretty natural for, you know, you get busy, you know, you may not necessarily work on trying to make sure you're up to date on different methods or have the latest thinking about what the FDA views as how you should approach different problems, and this is sort of a way of, you know, seeing that somebody does have that, you know, at the forefront of their mind in terms of their own development. You brought up the G-STAT program and mentioned that it was sort of a second step. So I guess how is it different than the P-STAT program?
It's a much easier application process for GSTAT. And Zoltan, if things have changed since I was involved in the committee, please correct me. But basically with the GSTAT, my understanding is you have a cover letter, your resume, and your coursework and degrees earned. And then you're a GSTAT, right? So there's no referees, there's no professional development activities. We're expecting people coming probably right out of school to apply for this. It doesn't have to be right out of school, but I think a lot of people either in graduate school or coming out of school are the ones applying for GSTAT.
So basically, I think it's just they just need to have the same minimum educational requirements that would be needed for a PSTAT, and then they have to agree to the ethical standards.
They're also very encouraging, both in SSC and ASA, of mentoring, so that, again, we forget about the solo statisticians. And I remember one of my first solo statisticians that I met many, many years ago, he actually worked up north of the Arctic Circle in a research area and supported something like 20 or 30 different scientists. And he was the only statistician. And this goes back before the internet was very popular or anything else. So he used to just love to come down and talk to other statisticians to sort of get that feeling of it. And many statisticians end up in a company or some such thing like that where they're the only statistician. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a big company, then you're going to get the naturally mentoring. Like Terry's talking about, we're bringing them in, we're training them. I'm sure there's a lot of mentoring going on. There's a lot of mentoring in our company as well. But if you're not with other statisticians, to be able to talk to somebody as your mentor, and it's very confidential, you might say, I'm thinking of changing my job, or I'm not sure about this, or I'm not sure about that, and you can get some advice from a more seasoned professional who is interested in you as a future statistician, not necessarily you as an employee of the company. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big plus for statisticians, especially if they're not going to be joining a big company with a large number of statisticians in a department.
So yes, that's the benefit for that's one of the big benefits for the GSTAT person. I just looked up the requirements just to confirm that yes. The requirements for the GSTAT they just need to have the same educational requirements as for PSTAT and have to agree to abide by ASA's ethical guidelines for statistical practice. So
as far as the requirements for someone who's going through a master's or doctoral program in biostatistics or statistics, this is a very low hurdle for getting the GSTAT designation. It's essentially you're accepting the ethical requirements of the ASA essentially as the one additional step, and then you can specify this designation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
So for students listening to that, it's a very low hurdle, so get on that.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking, why wouldn't you do that? If you're out looking for a job and it's one more thing you could put on your resume, and it's not that big of a hurdle to overcome, seems like you would want to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I like your way of summarizing it too, Terry, is that it shows a commitment to statistics as a profession. There's a lot of people who have PhDs out there, but if you've got your PhD plus your GSTAT, you're saying, well, I'm interested in developing myself into, you know, I know that there's more to it than just education, so I've got the educational component, but I want to become even better than that. I want to become an accredited applied statistician. I think that sends a very strong message to a future employer, if they're smart enough to know what it means.
Well, hopefully they'll just ask the question, what's that GSTAT after your name? So as far as a graduate student, so when depending on the duration of how long the sort of, I guess, the certification process, when would you recommend that a student apply for the GSTAT designation?
The educational requirement is a master's or equivalent in statistics, biostatistics, or, you know, a related statistics field, basically. So once they have that, you know, then that would be a good time to apply.
So it's pretty much, I guess, instantaneous. So if I just graduated in May, that I can submit my application, and how long would that take to get the designation from the ASA?
So just to be clear, it's GSTAT, right?
GSTAT.
But Zoltan, you know more about the cues for the accreditation process at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's no fixed, you know, obviously it varies depending on the individual case, and, you know, it can vary from a few weeks to, 4 weeks. Depends, because they need to be reviewed by 3 reviewers, and so depending on the time available that these people have to conduct the review and to get the response back, and this kind of thing. So, yeah, it can take a few weeks.
So if somebody, say, is earning a master's degree on the way to a doctorate degree, they can apply and get the GSTAT as a master's, and then as soon as, I guess, they finish with their PhD, they would have the designation based on their master's, assuming that happens within the 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you'd want to look at, see which school they got their master's. I mean, you have to verify that it's a legitimate,
right.
You know, not that that happens very often, but I mean, I used to check to see, you know, make sure, and sometimes even look at the coursework just to make sure that it does look like a statistics degree, because obviously there are many schools around the country that one can get degrees at,
and
degrees.
So I think part of this larger discussion, and I think we've touched on it a little bit, it seems like the ASA accreditation programs try to answer the question, sort of, for practitioners, who's best qualified to conduct statistical analyses. And so, for example, when I was a statistician working in the ophthalmology field, you know, I would come across some individuals who, you know, may have had the basic statistics class, but, you know, you don't really get a whole lot of exposure to accounting for correlation among the eyes. So, you know, they would be analyzing the eyes within patients as if they were sort of independent observations, and not really taking that into consideration. And in some ways you see similar concerns within my current industry, the software industry, where statisticians may be uncomfortable when non-statisticians are using statistical analysis or performing statistical analyses with various software packages. But we also have this issue where there's not enough statisticians to go around to do all the work. So how do we best tackle this issue? Do you think statistics courses for non-majors need to move, say, from calculations and computations to really one where people spend more time on the assumptions and the interpretations of the statistics? Or do we need to have just do a better job of emphasizing? I think several of you brought up this point that if you have one or two statistics courses, that doesn't make you a statistician, in much the same way that if I had 2 or 3 biology courses, that wouldn't make me a biologist or licensed to perform medicine. So how do we sort of best address this issue?
I don't think you can. A lot of it is experience. I mean, that's all there is to it. I think it's when I think, I don't mind if somebody, you know, pretty new is using a piece of software which is fairly well known and people understand it, something like SAS, as long as they've checked all the assumptions and they've done it. It's when they say, what did you run? You say, well, what do you mean? Well, what options? Well, I didn't choose any options. SAS knows best. And it's like, oh, my God. You know, right away, no. SAS knows best what runs fastest and what does everything else, but not necessarily for your, you know, each one of those options has to be known and understood to be used. And I think once you get that through to them, that's okay. But where it really starts with is the design. It's being able to put together a theoretical framework. That's the part where it would be very hard to train someone, unless they were a tremendous subject matter specialist. Mm-hmm. And you probably see this with some of your engineers, Terry. They can probably be as good as a statistician in an extremely narrow area that they just know and understand very, very well, and the statistics in that area are known and understood very well, and the designs are known and understood. But as soon as something new comes up, it's would they recognize that they've now entered new territory? And that you can't take a course on.
And that's really when we teach courses here, that's really what we try to get through to our engineers, is we're going to kind of give you the basics, but the real goal of this course is for you to realize when you're out of your comfort zone, right? When do you need to come to talk to one of us? And we will go through the software. It's very applied courses, right? We don't teach theory. If they can do the application, that's the key part of their job, right? So, but during the courses, I will go through examples of, look, the software spit out an answer, and look, the answer's not correct, right? I mean, software will spit out answers if you don't blow it too badly, right? But it's sometimes not the right answer.
Right.
And so going through some of that and just showing them that, you know, a lot of people can put, you know, variables into dialog boxes, but are you putting the right ones in the right spot? And like you said, Janet, asking for the right options when that happens. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I don't think there's a quick fix, you know, in terms of, you know, what can be done to forever and ever prevent misuse of statistics.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an ongoing experience, learning, you know, constant learning, and practicing and working in the field that makes you a good statistician. So,
and I think
ASA's
mission for this, right? So I don't think it's something we're going to solve on a podcast.
Right, right.
No.
Mm-hmm. At least we can get the conversation started so that...
Well, yeah, and to have more people advocate for statistics, right? I mean, that's definitely a benefit if we can get that going.
Right, so even if we're in a situation where employers who don't know what a statistician should do, that, you know, if they do the minimum and look at, oh, here's this organization, the ASA, that says, oh, we have this accreditation program, so I should at least be looking for people with an accreditation if I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah. And I talk to several managers outside of my group and say, look, when you decide you need a statistician, let me help interview. And
right.
And they're happy to have that help, right? Because they know they don't really know what we do.
Yeah, you can kind of, at least in the pharmaceutical industry, you can kind of tell, depending on who's written the job qualifications, because a lot of times it's, you know, depending on, it looks like the same thing's been written, no matter whether you're fresh out of school or you're a director. The requirements are basically written the same. It just kind of points to a lack of understanding about what may be needed for a particular job. So, yeah, I agree. So I guess as a final question, how do you envision accreditations changing in the future? And we talked a little, I talked a little bit with Lisa Lavange in episode 50 about how diverse statistics has become, and if you look at the sort of the course load that students have to take, there's so many different kinds of different statistical challenges that people, you know, can get experience in, and whether we're talking about, you know, non-parametrics or different kinds of modeling, or if we want to take into account some of these data science challenges with large data sets and different kinds of computational methods, missing data, observational data. So at the end of the day, you know, people could be in school forever. So do you envision maybe one day that there'd be some kind of specializations for different types of methodologies as part of the accreditation process? Or, I mean, currently on the ASA site, it lists that somebody has an accreditation, but it may not necessarily list a particular specialization.
I don't think so. My take on it is that there is a central body of knowledge, statistical principles, and so on that can apply to all areas. Mm-hmm. And where the differences occur is you have different problems to address and you need different tools. And so you adapt these tools and people become specialists in them. And, but I don't see the ASA coming out with, a PSTAT for survey statisticians and one for biometrics and one for psychology. And mm-hmm. I think that would be,
it's not labeled that way, Zoltan, but I mean, certainly you do get, I mean, that's why they've got different subject matter specialists on the review committees, because I couldn't really review very well, somebody who was coming from an economic or a business background, the kind of, okay, they do risk analysis, they do life tables, they do a whole bunch of things, but it's the finesse with which they do it mm-hmm. that I would not be able to judge, and it's the finesse that separates the GSTAT from the PSTAT, and I think that you can only do that within a pretty narrow subject matter.
Well,
so
I
they don't
agree.
Put it on the website, but I think you do specialize, and people would know that.
You're right. That does happen. I mean, I think that, I think that there's an effort to have reviewers who are somewhat familiar with the area that the candidate is working in. But I don't know if that will ever be formalized in terms of, a different designation. Is that what you were thinking of, Richard? Like,
I guess not necessarily a different designation, but I have a PSTAT, but it may list, say, regulatory statistics or clinical trials, or I have particular experience with missing data problems, or just a listing of different sort of subspecialties.
I believe in the ethical guidelines that we're required to agree to, it says that you will work in, I don't know how it's worded, but it says something like you will only work in the field of statistics for which you are qualified. And mm-hmm. if you get outside your comfort zone or however it's worded, then you will go get expert advice. So I think that is one way to try and mitigate somebody. I could not do FDA trials. I have no experience. I'm not qualified. I should stay away from those, right? So, but in terms of like industrial statistics, I can do that.
Okay.
So, and then the second thing I was going to mention is last year at JSM at the Council of Sections meeting, they talked about, we had a board of directors pass down, and one of the things they talked about is possibly coming up with accreditation for a data scientist, which would be separate from the PSTAT. It's a discussion point now. It's not something they've agreed to. It's under discussion. So in terms of not breaking up statistics into categories, but maybe adding this additional type of accreditation. So
I see.
One of the, what would be, because of this continual learning that we're all up against too, I'd really like to see people who design courses and give them, they should get a lot of credit for that. I think they should get more credit than just writing an academic paper, because it's a lot more work and whatnot to put something, to put a good course together and deliver it. And yet it's kind of seen as a nice to have, but it's not seen on a peer level as somebody who's able to put publications out. And if we're going to continuously learn from the people, and you have to be able to learn from the people actually who are on the cutting edge right now, because statistics is changing so rapidly, Right. That would be nice to, if somebody had created that course, then to me, then that's, we're supposed to be doing 5 credits a year, I think. That would be all 5 credits rolled up into one because you've done this course and you're helping to train other people. Hmm. So there's ways in which we could encourage people who are on the cutting edge to try to translate, take the time to translate some of that learning into a, you know, digestible bites for the rest of us. Because a lot of it is, there aren't even books out there.
Mm-hmm. You do get credit for that, don't you, Janet? I mean, if you give a course, that's you get credit for that.
But we would encourage them by saying it's worth all 5 of your credits. So instead of me taking 5 small courses, if I created one which was of a significant weight in an academic quote, then well, that covers off all 5 of your credits, because you're probably really focused just in that area. If you're at that level, and you may or may not be going outside and taking other courses and feeding in, you're actually creating the new science as you go along.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, any course you gave Janet would be great, but how would we know that if I gave a course, it would be as good? You know, like, what about the quality of the course? Does that matter or doesn't matter?
Well, but that's where encouraging people who are on the cutting edge, I think, are the most important ones that we can talk to, Zoltan, because it speaks to this whole thing about how do you keep up with statistics. And the one of the ways in which we keep up is sitting in on courses and going to conferences. And conferences are really expensive because not only do you have to fly there, put yourself up, and all, you know, you're losing time from work and whatnot. For consultants, that's you're paying double. You're paying the money out and you're not getting the money in. And for a lot of independents, it's very, very expensive for them to manage that. So a lot more on the webinars, seminars, distance education sort of thing, mm-hmm. Well, it would be really, really helpful to help keep the professional statisticians up to date, and then giving credit where credit is due to someone who gave the course. So you prepare this cutting edge course and you give it and you say, okay, well, you're good for this year for your credits for learning, because you haven't learned like the rest of us. You've learned ahead of us so that you can teach us. It's that concept.
Yeah. I don't think they have a very draconian, method. You know, they don't. I think that if you were to make that argument, you could probably swing it. I don't think that would be a problem.
No, but it would just be to get it out there.
Yeah.
Just to get it out there to encourage people, because there is a whole new world out there that some of us will never touch, but we should at least be a little bit aware of. And a lot of it is in a lot of the AI stuff that's coming out, other things along those lines. It's fascinating. And would I practice in that area? No, but I'd like to know about it, because that area is going to migrate into mine pretty soon, and I better keep up to date.
You learn by teaching.
Yeah,
but you got to know something about what you're teaching. Yeah.
Well, I think this was a useful discussion. I mean, first and foremost, I think if you're a graduate student with a statistics degree, get that the GSTAT certification. And, you know, certainly if you're a practicing statistician, you know, really consider getting that PSTAT designation. And if you're a manager, I guess, you know, it would be good to encourage your employees to work on that PSTAT designation, just as something as part of your continual development to get that. Any final thoughts from anybody?
Nope.
I agree with you 100%,
Richard.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, well, yeah, thank you for your time today and for talking about this. And hopefully there isn't too much of a wave of applications. Or if there are, maybe that would be a good problem to have.
maybe there's a reason that Zoltan retired, so he could deal with all the applications coming in on a full-time basis.
Well, that's great. Yeah.
The dream come true.
Yeah.
My contingency plan, you know.
Well, thanks,
thank you, Richard.
Okay. Everybody.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, everything you need to know for ASA accreditations. The theme for this year's Regulatory Industry Statistics Workshop is Evolution of Statistical Science, Translating Data to Innovative Healthcare. Registration opens June 1st, and be sure to register early as the 2017 workshop sold out. As a reminder, we have a panel discussion among statistics and data science podcasters at this year's JSM meeting in Vancouver. This session is tailor-made for the 2018 meeting theme, hashtag Lead with Statistics. This format, a nod to our social media age. Joining me will be John Baylor of Stats and Stories, Katie Malone of Linear Digressions, Kyle Polich of Data Skeptic, and Alexander Schott of The Effective Statistician. Look for the session in the online program and please try to attend. Finally, have an idea for a podcast or have a question? Send me an email at rzink@targetpharmasolutions.com. That's rzink@targetpharmasolutions.com. See you next time.